This is an ABC podcast.
Do you think you'd never be caught out by disinformation? Well, cast your mind back. Remember that big story about the bedbugs at the Paris Olympics? Well, that was actually a very effective Russian disinformation campaign. So effective that most people still believe it to this day. G'day, it's Hamish McDonald here. And I've learned that disinformation can be surprisingly subtle and hard to spot. If you want to join me interrogating the dark world of disinformation, stream The Matter of Facts now on ABC iView.
Around the globe, investors cheered the ceasefire agreement between the United States and Iran, with remarkable rallies in the value of stocks and an oil price plunge. But there are already signs this fragile truce isn't holding, with contradictory reports about just how open the crucial Strait of Hormuz actually is. So will this market wave crash as quickly as it's crested? And is the energy crisis actually over? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm ABC News Business Editor Michael Yander.
All right, Michael, let's recap where we're at. It's about 10:30 a.m. here in Sydney. We have had now more than 24 hours since Donald Trump took to social media to announce this ceasefire, but the last 24 hours has shown that the agreement hasn't been fully agreed to, seemingly by both sides, and there are contradictory messages coming from Iran and the United States about what has been agreed to and whether or not this ceasefire is actually holding.
Yeah, it's so important that you timestamp that, Carrington, because things are changing by the hour. We're getting different reports out. We saw a lot of different reports overnight. There's a key one from the Wall Street Journal that the Strait of Hormuz is not open and that the Iranians are currently blockading ships in retaliation for those Israeli strikes on Lebanon. That's something we've seen come out from the Iranians as well. And even if the Strait of Hormuz is open, the Iranian understanding is that they will be charging tolls on ships passing through and that they will still get to decide which ships pass through that strait. And the current numbers look like they're maybe willing to allow a dozen or 15 ships a day through. Before the war, that was 130 plus.
Yeah, so two crucial points you're making there. One is Iran and the United States do not seem to agree whether or not Lebanon is included in this ceasefire agreement. And Iran is using these Israeli strikes on Lebanon as a rationale for why it is that they aren't allowing the Strait of Hormuz to be more open than it seems to currently be. And they are now declaring it's actually closed.
And currently, all analysts looking at the ship tracking data say only about three ships have passed through since the ceasefire was announced.
So nowhere near normalization there. But also this fundamental question when we come to think about how energy markets might now look post-war in Iran, and whether or not this Strait of Hormuz will effectively be treated like the Suez Canal or Panama Canal, where Iran takes a toll from the ships that pass through, not only decides who goes through, but then clips the ticket, which will only lead to increased prices for key commodities, obviously oil, the big one, but also natural gas and fertilizer. And so we may not see anywhere near a normalization of prices because this is going to force up the price of that travel.
Yeah, and I guess wrapping it together with what we saw yesterday was that initial optimism that this is the taco, Trump always chickens out, we will get a deal, he likes making deals, there will be some great deal between the US and Iran that everyone can live with, but already we're seeing the cracks in that. So the 2%+ gains we saw on Wall Street overnight are very shaken. We've seen the ASX sell off in early trade before pulling back again. And I think it's all going to be very volatile until we see the outcome of these potential negotiations, which may not even happen because the ceasefire is so fragile that it looks like it could fall apart, as you say, literally a day after it was signed. And we're seeing other countries that are just unhappy with some of the terms of this, like Singapore's government has come out and said that it does not accept and will not accept tolls on ships passing through, navigable waters. It's against international law. And for a maritime economy like Singapore, it's a major trading hub. And the Greek prime minister has come out saying something similar, that this is just not acceptable because, of course, a lot of ships are registered in Greece and Greece has a major shipping industry. So the US and Iran are doing these negotiations, but the rest of the world is affected and they want a seat at the table too.
Let's look through some of those numbers that we saw overnight because they were remarkable. I mean, the TARCO Tuesday in the United States trade did seem to be on in a big way. The S&P 500 up 2.5%. We saw the tech-heavy NASDAQ Composite up 2.9%. The Dow also up about 2.9%. Europe, though, it saw its biggest rally since 2022. The stocks Europe 600 up 3.9%. And that's in part because Europe is so reliant on gas in particular, the global price for gas, and it has seen its shares hammered because of this energy crisis. So obviously a huge amount of relief there. And we did see the price of crude plummet, but we've seen it creep back in the hours since then as these reports have come through suggesting actually the agreement, particularly around that Strait of Hormuz, does not seem to be airtight. There seems to be major disagreement about exactly what's included and obviously a fear that this could break at any moment.
Yeah, so in terms of oil, we saw Brent trading around $110 a barrel more or less before Trump announced the ceasefire agreement yesterday, then plunged at one point, got close to $90 a barrel for the key futures contract, which has been cheaper than some of the actual for immediate delivery contracts, which have been much more expensive because people want the oil now.
Yeah.
The refineries are starting to run out. They are desperate for whatever supplies they can get, say from the North Sea, from the US. That's why we're seeing the physical market trade at levels far higher than the futures, the benchmark that we always talk about. We're talking, you know, a difference of $30+ a barrel between oil that's available right now and oil that is available for delivery in July. But we've seen, as you say, that even that futures price creep back up. When we're recording, that was around $97 a barrel for Brent. So well off those lows that we saw on the ceasefire optimism.
So when we saw these rallies overseas, the companies that have been sold off the most were those that we saw the biggest bounce back for. And they are obviously companies that are very reliant on, first of all, the price of energy. So you saw your big airline companies in the United States have quite remarkable jumps, but also companies that are relying on consumer spending being up. And so we saw a pretty broad-based rally, but obviously particular companies did better. But what is your assessment of this relief rally, this pullback from the brink rally, and how sustainable it might be and how vulnerable particular companies could be to a major pullback if we see what is looking like a fragile agreement completely break in half?
Well, we've seen already on the Australian share market, the biggest gainer is energy, up about 2.6% when we were recording. And that tells you something. That's reflective of the rebound back from those lows yesterday in oil prices.
And the context is important here. Australia, because of timing, is kind of ahead of this wave. Because the information was coming in yesterday when Donald Trump pulled back from that deadline or nullified the deadline just before the Australian market opened, but it was after the US had closed. So we saw a very strong rally in the Australian market yesterday, $80 billion of value added to the stock market. But that's basically what we then saw in the US to follow. So now we're on the other side of the
and
agreement
we're
looking
shaky. So much more caution on the Australian market today. Down a bit at the open, heading towards flat. Who knows what it will be by the end of trade today. We do know the energy sector leading gains. As you say, it's not just the consumer effects and the practical effects that are pushing down share prices in some other sectors on this conflict. It's also the inflationary effect and the fear that interest rates will have to rise as they have done in Australia, but haven't done yet in Europe or the US or other countries as a result of the inflation spike from this supply shock. Now, if that happens, that undermines the value of a lot of companies, particularly in the tech sector. And that's actually the biggest reason that we've seen tech hit quite hard by the sell-offs around these conflict concerns. Because the higher interest rates rise, you need a bigger return, particularly on much more speculative investments like tech companies that don't yet make a profit, but you hope will do in 10 years' time.
Yeah, and people talk about tech doing well in a risk-on environment where people are feeling positive about the future and about the path for interest rates, that we see people willing to take a bet effectively on tech being able to make major profits into the future. They're willing to accept these companies spending a huge amount of money now investing in, for example, the artificial intelligence boom, building those data centers, signing up to buy a lot of computer chips. But once it starts to look a little bit shakier, either the whole global global economy is looking shakier, or it looks like interest rates are going up, then you do start to see people get a little bit more wary about investing in those type of companies. And that's why we're seeing these kind of wild oscillations on global markets.
Yeah, well, interest rates are reflective of the time value of money and also risk. And if I can get 5 or 6% for parking my cash in a safe, you know, bond now, maybe I'll take that over the potential for 10 or 15% in 5 years' time if I invest in a tech startup.
You've been looking at this note from the Commonwealth Bank, and I'm interested in even just the background of the way that they've changed their economics team in order to have the right people in the right positions in order to assess what's going on in geopolitics and then what that means for what's happening in the Australian economy and what's happening to markets.
Yeah, so the CBA late last year hired someone called Madison Cartwright, who's their senior geo-economist, i.e. geopolitics and economics put together. The fact that Australia's biggest bank now feels it needs a geo-economics department and to bring people in to strengthen their understanding of the global political economy and how that's shaping the domestic economy tells you something, which is these events half a world away in the Middle East are directly affecting what will happen in Australia's economy. CBA is obviously particularly concerned in what will happen with interest rates in Australia, and that is directly linked to what's going on in the Middle East because it's linked to inflation, which at the moment is being primarily driven by this energy shock and price increase.
We also received the minutes from the Federal Reserve. This is for their most recent decision where they kept things on hold. Obviously, there's been a huge amount of pressure exerted by the US President Donald Trump on the current Federal Reserve Board. The outgoing chair of the board, Jerome Powell, who was appointed, we need to keep reminding people, to that position by Donald Trump in his first term, but they have completely fallen out since. Donald Trump says the Federal Reserve is being too slow to cut interest rates, been putting a lot of pressure on them. The minutes show that most of the board still believes that an interest rate cut will be coming at some point during this year, but it's a real
it's a lot
debate.
Less definitive now, isn't it?
And there are pressures both way, and you can see them really grappling with what's happening in the Middle East regarding the inflationary pressures of this supply shock on oil. That on one hand is inflationary, it's pushing up prices, but they are aware that that also potentially puts pressure on the employment market in the United States, and they're worried about potentially dealing with the situation again. A scary prospect for central bankers of stagflation, that they will see on one hand prices going up, but also unemployment rising.
Yeah, and the context here too, Carrington, central banks are still scarred by the experience of COVID and then the Russia invasion of Ukraine, where for a long time, many months, major central banks here in the US, in Europe, described inflation from that supply shock as transitory. Turned out it wasn't, and they had to massively increase interest rates.
It was transitory. It went for a very long time.
Exactly. It was a very, very long transit and required a lot of interest rate increases to get it back under control. And once bitten, twice shy. And we've seen that with the Reserve Bank of Australia, which copped more criticism than most because it was the last major central bank to respond to that supply shock inflation. And it copped a lot of criticism from the economics profession, even led to a review in part into the Reserve Bank about it being too slow to react. And we've seen it be preemptive this time. The concern would be that, likewise, in the US, there's a limit to how far the Fed can hold off and say this is transitory before they have to say, well, actually, inflation's just getting high and the economy's pretty strong, so we need to raise rates.
And they're like here, they are dealing with this dual mandate, which at times is in opposition, which is they're wanting to keep price rises predictable. So they're targeting relatively small increases in the price of goods, but they're also trying to keep employment high. They don't want to see mass unemployment. And this is one of those tests for the board about, well, which one are you prioritizing? On one hand, they want to get inflation even further down, but they are concerned now about the potential threat of rising unemployment, although it should be pointed out unemployment is still very low in the United States.
And just bringing it back home again, because people might be wondering why you're talking about the US Federal Reserve, where here in Australia the Reserve Bank does its own thing. Yes, it does, but what the Fed does has a major impact on the Australian Central Bank, because aside from trying to reduce demand by increasing your mortgage repayments, one of the principal channels through which interest rate rises reduce inflation is through the exchange rate effects.
Yeah.
And at the moment, the Australian dollar is relatively stronger than it would be otherwise, because our central bank has raised twice while other central banks are still sitting on their hands. And that's seen the Australian dollar propped up. If the US Federal Reserve starts to raise rates, or if markets think it is about to start raising rates, the US dollar will be boosted by that. And relatively, the Reserve Bank of Australia will get less of an effect because the Australian dollar will be pushed lower. And they might have to try harder by raising rates even further to keep up, because it's about these interest rate differentials between major economies like us and the US.
Yeah, we're an interconnected world, but the United States plays well above its weight band when it comes to setting interest rates globally and the importance of currencies. As the Reserve Bank Governor Michelle Bullock has pointed out, because a lot of people would say, how could you be so cruel as a central bank to be hiking interest rates at a time where people are already paying more for filling up a tank of fuel, or going to be paying more when it comes to the second round impacts of higher energy costs? One of the reasons that they hike interest rates, as you said, is to increase the value of the Australian currency effectively. That makes it cheaper for us to purchase things. It puts down pressure on inflation. But it also means, yes, people have less money to spend because they're having to spend more money on servicing their mortgages. But then it also incentivizes people to save, because you're going to get a higher return on the money sitting in your savings account. So these are the things that the Reserve Bank grapples with, just like the Federal Reserve. They're not doing it out of cruelty. What they're trying to do is to get inflation under control, because they know how painful out of control inflation is.
And just to bring it all back to what's happening in the Middle East, because I think it's important to kind of head towards that. That is the key issue. The Reserve Bank and other policymakers will be looking very closely at that. And we just don't know what is going to happen. I've seen notes out this morning. As we discussed at the top, the UAE has had 17 ballistic missiles and 45 drone attacks reported since the apparent ceasefire came into force. Kuwait, 28 drones intercepted at the time those analysts were writing those notes this morning. We've seen a key Saudi pipeline hit by an attack. Fortunately, doesn't seem like it did much damage, but that's a vulnerability to 5 million barrels a day of oil that are currently being piped from the east of Saudi Arabia to the west so that it can be shipped out. So oil prices, hugely volatile. We could easily see them go right back to where they were. That, again, feeds through to this inflationary impact that we've talked about. We are living in very interesting times, very dangerous times, and very unpredictable times. And, we've already got possibly around 13 million barrels a day of oil production that's been stopped and so-called shut in until this conflict ends in a meaningful way. The Middle East oil producers are not going to reopen those wells, which takes weeks, maybe even months, and repair them if the conflict is not resolved, because then they're just vulnerable to shutdown again or damage. This is not going to end in weeks, even if a deal is struck between the US and Iran.
Yeah, the language we are hearing from the Pentagon, the United States, with the Secretary of War, as the White House likes him to be called, Pete Hegseth, saying that this is a decisive military victory. There is no victory yet. And even if this ceasefire does hold for this 2 weeks to allow for negotiations to occur and some sort of agreement is put in place that seems like it can last at least some distance, we don't know whether or not there is going to be a new tolling regime. There is also a suggestion once again from Donald Trump that this might be some sort of shared revenue model with Iran. That
he loves a deal.
The ticket. He loves a deal, that they will somehow be doing a deal over which ships pass through that strait. But we don't have any real visibility yet on just how bad the damage is to the infrastructure in the Middle East, to the other Gulf states' production, and whether or not shipping companies are actually willing to take the risk of going through that narrow strait when this could flare up at any moment. That is it for today's episode. Michael, thank you so much for joining us on ABC Business Daily.
Thanks, Carrington.
Now, remember, you can catch That's Business with Alan Kohler tomorrow, who will be sitting down with Paul Schroeder, the CEO of AustralianSuper. And the head of Australia's largest superannuation fund has some extremely interesting and revealing observations about Australia's economy. I'll be back in your feeds on Monday, not once but twice, in fact, for a special bonus series you'll be hearing from us surrounding the global and local energy crisis and what it means for your day-to-day. So keep an eye out for an earlier episode release from us on Monday. To make sure you don't miss out on that, check that you are following ABC Business Daily on ABC Listen. If you'd like to send in a question, email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. Catch you next time, Michael.
See you, Carrington.